Welcome to KGVM, Voice of Gallatin Valley. I'm Diane Elliott. You are listening to Local Literati, a program that explores the adventures in writing experienced by local authors. Today we have with us Alf Kesselheim. He has published 11 books. His works run a river ranging from Threading the Currents, a spellbinding adventure that takes us as deeply into the waters of his psyche as those of North America. Silhouette on a Wide Land is an evolutionary tale of his transformation from academic to farmhand. A book I look forward to reading is Rambling as in Homeless, a tale that illuminates the gypsies living in the British Isles. And surprise of surprises, at least to me, a cookbook titled, would you believe, Trail Food. In addition to these books, he's written hundreds of magazine articles as well as curriculum guides, outdoor manuals, ad copy, adventure tales, equipment reviews, history, comedy, drama, profiles, environmental essays, and editorial pieces. His works have appeared in Audubon, Canoe and Kayak, Natural History, Family Fun, Men's Health, Backpacker, Outside, Montana Quarterly, Big Sky Journal, High Country News, Glamour, Montana, and other magazines. In addition to that, he's been a columnist, an editor-at-large, senior editor, a contributing editor. Al Kesselheim, pray tell, how have you managed to accomplish all this?
It's all about survival.
Indeed.
It's what you do. It's interesting listening to you read the list because as I was coming over here, I was thinking that some writers know their niche from the get-go and they're there. You know, it's a place or it's a theme. And I guess I think of myself more as a journeyman writer. You know, you need a gear review? Yeah, I can do that. You need humor? I'll give it a shot. Curriculum guide, kind of whatever.
I find the humor in your books just absolutely charming. And it always moves right with the flow. And the flow is always there no matter what you're writing. And I didn't realize how many books you had written. And this amazes me. I would really like to hear a piece that you've written.
Okay.
Could you read us a piece?
Sure. I sort of established myself as a writer writing adventure narratives.
Yes.
That was kind of my first niche in success. And one of my more recent books is called Let Them Paddle. And it's about the series of coming-of-age expeditions that we did with our three children in the wilderness, and we raised them, you know, in the wilds, a good part of their upbringing. Maybe I should start with that since that's really what kind of got me going as a writer.
I'd like that.
So this is a piece from the tundra in the far north, and if I can find it. It comes near the end of a journey with our first son's coming-of-age journey. So we were way up on the tundra of northern Canada and had spent almost 40 days out in the wilderness with our three children. And we'd really gotten there.
Oh.
So this is towards the end of that first long expedition. The Inuit think of themselves as the people. They don't mean by that they are in some way chosen or favored or superior. It means that they are authentic, real, of this place. The people. Nothing more or less. Most and perhaps all traditional Aboriginal cultures think this way. Each one is the people of their land. They're kin to everything that makes up their world. There's no separation between humans and wildlife and plants, even the water and rocks and weather. It's all a seamless piece. Boundaries are fluid, merging, overlapping, layered. Everything is alive, has spirit and sentience. The boulders brought down by floods, the lichen the caribou feed on, the birds nesting in the gravel, the wind tugging at the clouds, the stories told down the tunnel of generations, spiritual entities. Through it all, the river's course, as real and vibrant as the arteries in our bodies, the lifeblood of the land, whispering its truth, teaching lessons, sculpting. In that worldview, everything is bound together into a single interacting organism, constantly shifting, maintaining balance, informing the whole, learning from one another. The people knew how to live by looking around at the world. They paid attention. They listened. In this sense, my own culture is, well, retarded. My culture exists within an us and them reality. There is a gulf walling us away from other species. In between often lives fear, fear born of ignorance and inexperience. My culture considers itself chosen, superior, select. My culture does its damnedest to make this separation manifest. Buffered from weather, living in artificial environments, creating distance from other species, managing the world for its benefit, using things up, throwing things away, dominating. It's possible, and more common in my world, to find people who have gone through life without ever once really encountering the unfettered outdoors. Not once in a lifetime. To never have to survive a storm outdoors, to never have to build a fire to stay warm after a rain, to never feel the wind shift and know what it portends, to never encounter other species in their world on their terms. I have no pretension of approaching the spiritual elegance and understanding of the Inuit, their embeddedness. I'm passing through, doing my best, struggling to dissolve barriers, but I am not of that universe. There's too much to overcome. But this day, in this place, we are partway there. We have glimpses of enlightenment, understanding, moments of grace. I look at Ruby and Sawyer. Their hands and lips are stained blue with berry juice. Eli is whittling a piece of weathered wood. Our dinner fire flickers in the rocks. Mary Pat is bent over a pan full of bannock dough, working it into patties. Her cheek has a smudge of flour on it where she brushed a strand of hair away. The bugs are as bad as they were on day one, but we ignore them. We wave them off without comment. The river courses past. The rocks left by rasping ice grow warm under the late sun. Our skin is weathered and brown. Our hands are stiff and calloused, formed to paddle grips. We have held the artifacts of the Inuit, thought about what they mean, put them back into the ground where they were left. We have gazed into the eye sockets of men and women and children whose spirits gave up their bodies to the open tundra, whose stories float somewhere. We have locked eyes with muskox at 10 feet. We have knelt on top of the river as it carried us, speaking to us for many, many miles. More and more, we know how to behave by looking around us.
Oh, that is so wonderful. I have been amazed at how you capture. I take it you journal even when you're canoeing.
Sure.
Yeah.
I do.
And you've journaled your whole life.
Yeah, although I think of myself as kind of a sporadic journalist. I write on the occasions that seem worthy of, you know, making note of it. Not that all life isn't worthy of that, and there's some people who keep daily journals that are really profound journalists. I tend to concentrate on journeys, trips, expeditions, when I go someplace out of the ordinary.
Like when you were a farm or ranch hand, it was kind of dubious whether he was an actual rancher.
Very true.
You must have been journaling back then because you couldn't possibly remember all of those things.
No, I was very lucky to have journals from that time. And that was, you know, part of what kind of kept me sane that time out on the prairies of Colorado, where you're all alone in an old farmhouse and the wind's battering the house and you're just kind of out there.
And the cows are dying. And, oh, the tragedy. And yet, you made what came totally alive was the sincerity and the decency of people who are agricultural in their vocation. And you brought them into the same humanity as academics and gave them that same level. And I love that. I love that in your work, that you see other people's. You see and you share with us a whole host of information beyond dipping that paddle in the water.
Well, and especially when you're writing about other people. I mean, that's our job, isn't it, as writers, is you want to deliver some essence of a person or a life or a way of living.
Well, and what I didn't know is that you had written a novel. And I haven't read it. I'm really eager to. And do you imbue then in a novel all... do you get into the psyche of the people that you're writing? Or do... How do you develop your character?
Well, I think you have to just kind of live with them. To the extent that I've dabbled in fiction, you know, it's pretty limited. But you have to just... be in their world and spend a whole lot of time in there. And you know, you can savor a character for months or even years before you ever put pen to paper or touch a keyboard.
I know when I develop a character, I even know, I may never mention it, but I know what religion they were, whether they rebelled from it, whether they did not.
Sure.
I know from their birth what went on.
Yeah.
And it's a whole new person.
And I think you also have to be ready to be surprised by them, you know.
Always, because after you've established the character, they take you places you never dreamed you'd go.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like, oh, well, they can't do that. Let's see now. What are we going to do?
and they do it, and they take us to understanding of other persons the way we could never understand them, just looking at them, even talking to them.
Yeah.
Because we could... We understand them from their inner perspective, which they may not communicate to us. Our real people might not.
Right, right.
You have another book with you?
Well, I brought the Montana Real Place, Real People,
yes.
Which is also fairly recent. And it's a collaboration that I did with photographer Thomas Lee, who I've worked with on many, many stories. And we kind of created a best of book of the stories that we've worked on together. And they feature Montana people and places that we've had the good fortune to encounter over the years that we've worked together. And you just never know where a story's going to pop up. And these kind of unpretentious characters who nobody knows about really, except for a very small circle, but who have had these remarkable tales to tell and have led these big lives, you know.
Could you read us a tale?
Sure. Well, I'd love to read about, there's a woman that we did a story about named Elsie Fox, who some people...
What a great name.
Well, we interviewed her when she was 101 years old. She died a few years ago. She was born on the Powder River in about 10 years after Custer's last stand. And, you know, went to one-room schoolhouses, rode bareback to school and that kind of thing. But she saw such a swath of history. She lived through the Depression and the World Wars and, you know, all of these advances and whatnot. And along the way, she became a card-carrying communist. Which is kind of an interesting thing.
Who would dream in Montana?
I know. So I'll read a little excerpt that kind of brings that out. In the fall of 1929, the economy fell off the cliff. Over the next years, Elsie's employer had to let every other worker go. He and Elsie decided how much money they could each take home every week. Elsie's paycheck also supported her mother and stepfather, who were out of work. She remembers vividly the moment that started her down the path to becoming a dangerous woman.
Ooh.
It happened in 1931. She was walking back to the office from an errand at the bank when she came upon a demonstration. People were marching and protesting in the streets. She remembers a sea of gray people, gloom heavy in the air, along with a palpable desperation for food. It rocked Elsie's world. How could this happen? In a few months, life had gone from carefree to desperate, from plenty to scarcity. I remember thinking that the fish still swam in the ocean, trees still grew in the forest, and yet everything had changed. What caused this? I was sobbing when I came back to the office. That's when I went to the public library and started reading, she said. I asked for books on economic theory. It was then that I came across Karl Marx. The things he said made such sense to me and explained so much about what was happening with capitalism at that time. Then, as now, people felt adrift and uncertain. The foundations of their security had vanished. The future was forbidding and unclear. Most people hunkered down, depended on friends and family, lived day to day. Elsie Fox did that too, but she also began to take action. I don't know where it comes from, she said, finishing up a bowl of chili and her second slice of homemade bread. Ever since I was very young, I have felt the urge to fix things that weren't right, and I've always wanted to be in the thick of events. You see, it might look like I'm a dedicated activist, but it's more that I don't want to miss a thing. I find life intensely interesting.
Oh, I love that.
And she, when we were interviewing her, she had the 400-page dossier that she had gotten through the Freedom of Information Act from the FBI that labeled her under J. Edgar Hoover as a dangerous woman.
Well, pray for many dangerous women and no men doubt. In this world. We no. need them. But what it does is it. She has lived so long and through the things that we're going to be living through, and it gives me hope that we can return to that glorious moment when America was, the average person was living well.
Yeah.
And we could go to school, we could afford school.
Yeah.
And I look forward to that.
Yeah.
What are you doing now? What are you doing now? What works are you working on now?
I'm doing a lot of magazine writing. I'm actually in the thick of writing a story which has been kind of dominating my thoughts lately. It's about this whole epidemic of opioid use.
Oh.
So it's not the most uplifting topic, but it is.
But fascinating. I was just reading something about that, and I was going, how can this be happening?
It's unbelievable. And the people I've spoken to whose lives have been transformed in bad ways by it, they're just heartbreaking. And the.
Did you get into how they got there? How they went? What caused them to go in that direction?
Yeah. Well, there's no formula. There's no stereotypical user of opioids.
As different as people are.
Yeah. But I think the thing that kind of sets this apart is that it, right at the heart of it, is our medical establishment, our philosophy of medicine, and the pharmaceutical companies, and this drive to make money that's at the core of what has promoted this class of drug and now is trying to cope with it, and not very successfully. But it's.
I wish everyone in the world had a passion, as you have a passion for the waterways of America.
Mm.
As I have a passion for gardening. If everybody had a passion, it doesn't cost anything.
Yeah, and that's a big thing. I mean, that's a really major factor in these lives that have been sort of wasted by drug use. And people talk about, I had no idea at the time, but I lost 10 years of my life to, you know, taking those pills.
Wow.
And I think that's very true. If people have something that's bigger that helps them rise out of that, and it can be as simple as a pet or a garden or art or whatever it is that you are
drawn to.
Gives you meaning. So yeah. Anyway, so I'm doing a lot of these magazine stories. Everything from gear reviews for Canoe and Kayak magazine to opioid, you know, journalism. But I'm also working on this collection of, I think of it as kind of a lyrical adventure tale, which is really an outgrowth of that what if question that we've talked about before that's at the core of so much of kind of creative work.
I think that when you've written nonfiction and fiction prolifically, there comes a time, and I think it has something to do with our age, when words become more than getting us from A to B and telling the story, and they become music in themselves, and I suspect that that's where you're going. Could you read some of your current work?
Okay. Well, I brought two short pieces, and the idea behind this is that maybe it's possible to tell adventure stories and the little bright nuggets along the way, that you don't have to say we got up and had granola for breakfast again, but that you can highlight these little moments and glimmers along that path that allow other people in to think about where they've been and what they've done and tap into their universal experience as well. So every day on this expedition has a poem or a lyrical piece which tries to be that nugget. And I don't take myself as a poet, but anyway. This is on day 7. It's called Why All This Reckless Beauty? Why the laughing abandon of loons wailing through the night, filling the dark room of desire? Why the delicate unfurling raiment of wild iris, proud and fragile as a girl on prom night? Why the intricacy of hummingbird wingbeat, simply to mine nectar? Why the roiling sunbright billow of thunderhead, brilliant, towering with power? Why the iridescent dragonfly, the neon lichen, the spotted fawn, the frail monarch, the sturdy yellow bowl of pond lily? Why any of this startling excess, this ostentatious shout, when plain and utilitarian would do?
Oh, that is so poignant. Would you go back, because I want to end on your next poem.
Okay.
Would you go back and read us another piece from one of your books?
Okay. Let me take another piece from Let Them Paddle. And this is also from that first summer that we were up on the tundra with our marking the passage of Eli. And I'll read a little bit here. So again, this is fairly close to the end. We were at a place called Kazan Falls on the Kazan River, deep in the barren lands of northeastern Canada. A rock cairn, not an Inukshuk, marks the beginning of the portage trail. Someone has left a single muskox horn on the pile of rocks. It is smooth and heavy, beautifully curved, scored with ridges. Hollowed out, it would make a perfect ladle or bowl, a find the Inuit would have treasured. A battered metal ammo box rests in the rock pile. Inside, several journals full of entries logged by people who have made their way here and stopped long enough to scribble down their stories and impressions. We thumb our way back through the pages stained with squashed black flies, bits of food, grimy fingerprints, back through the years until we turn a page and see our names. July 24th, 1991. I remember Mary Pat that afternoon. She had opened the book and read a large title page dedicated to the Brotherhood of the Kazan. Brotherhood, my ass, she hissed. What about the damn sisterhood? This night, when we retire, we bring the ammo box into the tent with us. Everyone is arranged, sprawled on sleeping bags, journals and pencils in hand. Damp, fragrant socks hang from a drying cord strung across the top of the tent. The mesh pockets bulge with antlers and sticks, bags of fur, feathers poking out at odd angles. "Listen to this, you guys," Mary Pat says, and she starts to read. "To the Sisterhood of Kazan Falls. I am 7 months pregnant, but I am not the first pregnant woman to travel the shores of the Kazan River. The Inuit women have been doing it for centuries. It's nothing unique. Being here pregnant is not something my partner and I see as risky. If anything, there are fewer health risks here than in society. I hope my journey through this vast, open, life-giving, wild land in my condition brings out the more gentle, sensuous, female aspects of the barrens. We who have traveled the Kazan know of its harsh weather, challenging whitewater, and insistent bug population, but the traveler is the one creating the risks and the dangers, not the land. Being a woman adventurer, comfortable within the walls of sky, I know my own limitations. No, my partner did not stern the canoe the whole way. We traded days as usual. But yes, he did carry the canoe on every portage. Not that I didn't carry my share of 70-pound packs. Our pace was more leisurely, our style more relaxed. I feel we gave up nothing and gained a lot. I hope someday to return to this land with a life growing inside me and show her or him the elements of earth that nurtured their unborn body. Keep the land in balance and happy travels to all. Mary Pat Zitzer and the Grebe." As she reads, I watch Eli. He lies on his side, his head propped up with his hand, looking intently at Mary Pat. Chills run up my back. I can tell it hits him hard, these words from the past. They hit us all. We know what it has taken to get here, what it took us with Eli in the womb. Each of us listens from the perspective of our position in the family. The words fill the space in the tent. When Mary Pat finishes, her eyes glisten with emotion. Everyone looks at Eli, this grown young man reckoning with his origin. "The Grebe?" he says.
That I'm glad you mentioned Mary Pat and bring her in to your writing, as you so often do. I admired her pictures in silhouette on a wide treading the currents.
Yeah,
treading
she's
the
got
currents.
Pictures and
she is, and her photography.
Yeah,
fabulous companion.
Yeah.
It would seem that you two make a very fine pair.
Yeah, we've been very lucky to find each other. We have very equal appetites for adventure and being out and doing. We used to do these lecture programs, and people sometimes would come up afterwards and say, "How did you get your wife to go along with you?" And I'm like, "Are you kidding? You got it all wrong."
And isn't that what makes writing for us easy, that we have spouses that join in, don't interfere.
Our true partners. Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. That's great. Mm. We have time for another piece. Do you have a piece from Paddle? Or,
from the Montana book?
Yeah.
Let's see. What
we have time for that.
Okay. Let's see. It might be. Actually, there's a, let's see where that piece is. I could maybe read a little bit from the introduction that talks about the quality of these stories and the places that we've been. It's another partnership, this work with a photographer, Thomas Lee, that has been really special. And it's, in a way, this book is, we think of it as a kind of a duet. So the stories come to us. Thomas and I go out with a camera and notebook to see what's there. We interview people in cafes, in their living rooms, over lunch, in corrals, in prison parole hearing rooms, along riverbanks. We watched them feed chickens, jump irrigation canals, pet their dogs, make food, look at pictures, plant gardens, forge steel, sort mail, read the Bible. Mostly, for both of us, we wait for that crystalline moment, that revelatory scene or image that makes the whole. When Jerry Cornelius steps off of his back porch and nuzzles up with one of his horses, when Tia Cober pauses over the kitchen sink to gaze out at Young's Point looming over the Yellowstone River, where William Clark stopped to camp in July of 1806, that moment when Thomas catches Elsie Fox tapping her hand on the 400-page FBI dossier with her name on it, or he gets Frank Dryman gesturing his hands with a tattoo that led to his recapture in Arizona. Sometimes we recognize that moment. Bingo, we think. With other stories, it's only later that we realize that when Richard Stewart talked about the juniper tree he sat next to for solace, it is the metaphor the story has to hang on. Or that when Robin Puckett gets out of her truck halfway up a slippery hill and punches her pen into an electrical connection under the dash to make it start up again, it sums things up. The elegance is the melding of those photographs and those words, the bingo moments each of us brings to the table, which creates something greater than the sum of its parts. How that happens is largely a mystery. That it happens is the magic of a duet.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. I think we should end on a note of another poem.
Okay. Well, this is another short piece that comes towards the end of a summer spent in the North Woods of New England, and gives a glimpse of our partnership. It's called Hammock. Admit it, you were disdainful. A hammock, you said? You who worry so much about extra weight? Hard to take you seriously. You waved your hand in dismissal. I can picture it, I said, under the pines, after a long day full of portages, reading my book, resting my back. I'm taking it. And now look at you. Smug as a cat curled on a satin pillow, the hammock strung between roof corners of the picnic table shelter, it barely fits. And you, levitating above the scatter of gear and food, reading your novel, swaying slightly while the rain thunders down on the shingles over your head. Look at you there. Take my picture, you said.
Oh. Oh, that is wonderful. Al Kesselheim, thank you for sharing with us. Your work is outstanding.
Well, thanks, Diane, for having me.